So, as you would have known, and also known from the notices, that Easter is coming up soon. And Easter. And James has packaged together a little Easter series, of which I am the first. And I, the sort of topic he had for me was Easter in the Old Testament. So I had, at one of our meetings, I'd been enthusing about how much I'd be getting out of the Old Testament and the richness of the language and the richness of the ideas and all this kind of stuff. And I kind of got dumped in it. But keen to look at it, eh? So pretty happy to kind of go into it. So I thought, oh yeah, I know a few scriptures from the Old Testament that refer to Jesus and refer to the Easter story. But yeah, Susan, I hadn't quite comprehended how much of the Old Testament talks about Jesus and the Easter story. So if you can kind of track along with me, there's kind of three little ideas that I want to work with today. So the first one is just kind of that we're coming up to Easter. So just to start turning our minds towards Easter. You know how cows chew their cud, they eat something and then they bring it back up and then they eat it again and they bring it back up and they eat it again, which is a pretty gross thought. But kind of that idea with starting to just to mull over the Easter and what it means for us and kind of where we're going with it and some maybe some of the scriptures that I talk about today and maybe some of the ideas I talk about today. Just so I guess that's kind of where my first idea is going and my second idea that I want to talk about is a little bit legacy. What are we carrying? So I'm going to talk a bit from the Old Testament, so the legacy. And my third idea, hopefully we'll get to, is righteousness. A little bit around that. Okay. So, I love looking through the Old Testament. The thing that I talked to James about and the others about, I was looking for... I decided to read the Old Testament looking for God and looking for his attributes and like, okay, if I'm going to be like him, what does that mean? What are the little things? What does he like? What doesn't he like? And it's funny when you start reading like that, it's actually really quite clear. You know, he doesn't like people screwing other people over. Yeah, okay, I can do that, I think. He likes... people who follow him. He likes people who are generous. He likes people who live in right relationship with each other. Yeah, some nice stuff. I think I can do those kind of things. Anyway, so that's what I was looking for. But I like the obscurity of some of the Old Testament. I think I'm going to kind of end up there a little bit. But there's the obvious stuff, and let's go there first, the obvious stuff. So Easter in the Old Testament, straight away you think of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus quoted it on the cross, right? And it's really cool reading that psalm. I'm not going to read it because I don't want to stay there for too long, but you start to have a sense of what Jesus is feeling. You get a sense of his emotions. I am a worm, not a man. Wow, that's powerful, eh? It wasn't this. Sometimes, you know, I think sometimes we have this image of Jesus on the cross as portrayed by the sort of, I don't know what they are, Renaissance artists or something, artists through the ages, this kind of stoic, almost bloodless, just doing it tough on the cross, superhero styles. But I'm a worm, not a man. What does that say? It doesn't say that, does it? So this cool psalm really gritty psalm. My God, why have you forsaken me? And I, you know, I think Jesus intentionally quoted that so that people would start playing it in their mind. The people watching him would start playing it in their mind. Oh, this is what he's going through. And then the other really sort of one that I think back to is Isaiah 52:53, the suffering servant. Well, it's about a decade ago now, when The Passion came out, it was controversial, right? And one of the controversial aspects of it was that it was too gruesome. Again, sort of this moving away from these pretty portrayals of Jesus on the cross, little trickle of blood down his forehead, little stream of blood down his hands. And Isaiah 53, so The Passion the movie The Passion of the Christ was a step back from that and got people upset. But then you read Isaiah 52:53 and you're like, well, The Passion was just nowhere close to what actually might have happened, what actually happened was, I'll just have to find that scripture. So it says in Isaiah 52 that his appearance was disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness. It's pretty gruesome, eh? Passion wasn't like that. Beyond human likeness. I can't begin to imagine what that is. I tried to Google a few images, but it's just, you know. And then you kind of get a sense of, obviously there's the narrative of the story in the Gospels, what happened, the floggings, the beatings, but then a bit more texture in the Old Testament as well. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. Now, just the very thought of that, someone pulling hair from my face, just, you know. I did not hide my face from mocking, spitting. So I'm kind of imagining as bloody saliva messed up. So it's pretty gruesome, and that's some of what I like about the Old Testament. It just gives a real texture. It gives a lot more texture to sort of a brush over the Gospels might do, or to our ideas and images grabbed from sort of iconic pictures and this kind of stuff. And yeah, Psalm 22, I'm a worm, not a man. My heart has turned to wax, my mouth has dried up. Really textural, really descriptive, really good. Just giving, certainly for me, giving me a lot more sense of what Jesus suffered on the cross. And I know there's a lot of theories about why people didn't recognize Jesus after his crucifixion. But one of the ones that I think is that if you've been beaten up that bad and you're scarred, you're not going to look the same after you're healed. So we know that he wore his wounds after resurrection, and I quite like that idea that he was unrecognizable. But when people started hearing him and engaging with his spirit, that he was recognizable. Anyway. I want to jump into Peter, and I wonder if First Peter, and I wonder if we can get that up on the screen. So this is kind of where I want to go from. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Concerning the salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you searched intently and with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and the circumstances as to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. It was revealed to them they were not serving themselves but you when they spoke of the things that have now been told to you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, even angels long to look into these things. Pretty cool. I keep looking at that last bit. Even angels long to look into these things, and I can't. I haven't got anything. I can't get it. It's just like there's something there. It's amazing, but I can't get my mind on it. So another one of those kind of passages where you know it sounds quite nice. Flick your eyes over it, mm-hmm. And then you start chewing it, and you start, you know, doing the good cud impression, the cow impression, and mulling over the different parts of there. So the first bit of that really grabbed my attention was so obviously I went there because it's talking about the prophets, it's talking about the Old Testament, it's talking about the content is about people from the past that pointed towards Jesus. But the bit that grabbed my attention was the Spirit of Christ in them. Hello? What's he doing back there? So it was the Spirit of Christ in them that was pointing them to the sufferings and to the glories. And I kind of grabbed on that idea that it kind of makes sense, right? If all these prophecies were so accurately fulfilled in the life and the death and the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus, if he had gone and told them what happened, then of course they're going to be, right? So it's a little mind bender with time. But if you know, Jesus out of time went back and said, okay, here's some details you need to know. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to be beaten up. I'm going to live like this. I'm going to be tempted. And he drops them back in the Old Testament into the people of the Old Testament. And I was thinking, how would you do that? So I think of how we get prophecy. It's kind of a bit wishy-washy sometimes. It's kind of a bit iffy sometimes. You know, we're humans. It's pretty rare that we get an audible words of God coming in our ears, write it down, right? And maybe some of the prophets got that. But I reckon that they got the same kind of stuff as us as well. Impressions, images, visions sometimes. They got some other stuff. So the Spirit of Christ is carrying this really important message about himself. He's taken it back. And he wants to lay it down in history. Jesus wants to lay it down in history. And he's working with people in this way. Little images. Little pictures. A vision here. Maybe an audible voice there. And then he's also working with a different time. He's working with a Roman Empire. A way of executing people that wasn't around 4,000 years prior to that. So he's working with ideas. So he needs to think about, of course he probably does it a lot easier than I am, what pictures are going to resonate, and he drops them in. And I kind of think of it like a puzzle. He's just dropping a puzzle piece here. Okay, Isaiah's got a few. He's quite good. He's pretty reliable. He's a bit closer to the time. Zechariah, yeah, we'll drop that one in there. Okay, yeah, David's a good guy. Drop a few puzzle pieces over there. Life of Moses, people of Israel. Lots of puzzle pieces. And it says that the prophets, they had their piece, but they started to bring together. They started to do what we're doing, like chewing the cud. They started to bring the little puzzle pieces that they knew about. Maybe the serpent on the cross. Moses raised the serpent on the cross, which Jesus drew attention to. Just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the desert, so the Son of Man will be lifted up. Maybe it was that. Maybe it was some of the suffering servant stuff. And they pulled this puzzle together and they try to make sense of it. And they had help, obviously. They had the Spirit of Christ in them, trying to help them to, okay, I've dropped these little hints of me throughout the Old Testament, throughout history. And pulling them together. Got a little bit lost. And he himself pulled them together, I think, for there's a story about Jesus walking with after his resurrection, walking with the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. And it says that in that time, he discussed basically what we're talking about now, from Moses, so from Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, through the prophets, he talked to them about how the scriptures had indicated, had pointed to him, had indicated that he was going to do this and what was going to happen to him. So I had a little think about this, and apparently it's 12K from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and I know that once upon a time, way back, I did the very stupid thing of walking home from Wellington to Porirua, which took me, it's about 20K, took me about 3 hours, and I was probably huffing along a bit faster than Jesus and those two disciples. So I reckon maybe about 3 hours for 12K at a sort of conversational pace, maybe 4 hours. So quite a long discussion, and man, it would have to be right to cover quite a bit. So that's kind of my first thing, is just a kind of encouragement to look. And to read and to grapple with, and to think again and to think again, and to read what other people have written about it, and to ask God to reveal stuff, and to think again, and just allow it to sit and soak and give you a bit more. You know, when you listen to really great Bible teachers, so I listened to a bit to Dallas Willard and a bit to Thingamajig. Tim Keller, really good Bible teachers, and just bring a bit more to your life and to your existence and to how to live. So yeah, so that's my first point. Done. Actually, it's not quite done, but I might leave it there. So much stuff that Jesus would have gone through. Genesis, first bit of Genesis, Genesis 3:15. I think probably the first reference, it's quite a well-known one, that about the, I'll read it. I'll put enmity between you, talking to Adam and Eve, between your offspring and the serpent's offspring. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. So that's probably the first reference to Jesus on the cross, that Jesus will defeat Satan, the serpent, at the cross, but he would bite his heel, which is obviously death, suffering, not a pleasant thing. I thought a bit more about this road to Emmaus thing, journey, and wondered what aspects that Jesus picked up on. But I think I'll leave that there. I was quite intrigued by the story of Noah as well, because I don't have memories of it as being talked about as a image of Christ, and the one thing that especially that I had never really connected onto was that. So this the story of Noah is about, I guess, in some ways, the overcoming of evil, and the continuing on of righteousness. But there's this little detail at the end, which, you know, it's a well-known detail of the story, which is the releasing of the dove. And I was like, well, if this is a story about the Easter story, what's the dove? It's the Spirit of God, right? Where did it go? To the whole world. It went over the world, looking, and then came back. I think that's kind of a nice. It's nice, because I think that's something that I've never really registered with. That maybe way back then we got this little idea of God sending a spirit to the world. Cool. Anyway, so the story I really wanted to focus on today was, and I'm probably going to display this for a while, about Cain and Abel. So maybe slightly less known, kind of is in there somewhere, but maybe not quite as well known as some of the other stories. And so I'm just going to read a little bit. Now, Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favour on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favour. So Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now Cain had said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother and Abel killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where's your brother?" "I don't know," he said. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you're under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand." And then there's a curse attached to that. So why is Abel prophetic? Why is Abel a prophetic image of Easter, of Jesus? It's a bit strange, isn't it? I mean, Abel's a bit of a it's not very active. It's kind of the passive guy in the story. The active guy is Cain. He's playing. Cain's making all the moves. Cain's got the big conversation afterwards. So. You know, why does Abel get airtime in the Bible? And you know, some people think it's because he made a blood sacrifice, and that was the pattern that went on from there. That was that the blood was the thing, you know. Sacrificed the lamb, and that was a representation of Jesus on the cross, etc. Maybe. I'm not so much on that one. And probably more recognised was the quality of what they brought. So if you heard in the passage, it says that Cain brought some of the fruits of his, or whatever it was, some of, and that Abel brought the fat portions of the firstborn, which I kind of think is like maybe like Cain going to a school bag and getting the half-eaten three-day-old sandwich and kind of, there you go. Whereas, you know, Abel's fat portion's the best part. And then sort of this idea of the firstborn, the intentionality, I'm given the top, the first bit of earning I got, there it is, this is my livelihood, it's my first 20 bucks. I don't know how you get fat portions off $20, but first 20 bucks and then my best 20 bucks, $100 or whatever, $1,000. So So, yep. I'm going more with that idea. But we only that's all we know about Abel. That's all we know was that he was the son of Adam and Eve. He farmed sheep, and his brother killed him. So, pretty lean details, eh? But I think that if we're taking another slice of his life, so all we have is this one little slice. But I think if we'd taken another slice, we would get the same Abel. Fat portions, intentionality, looking towards God. And then if you look on the flip side of it, we've got a bigger picture about Cain. Argumentative, obviously done this thing. I mean, it's how many humans were around at that point? 4? Where's your brother? I don't know. Who's killed him? Adam? Doesn't leave many options, does it? Anyway, so quite kind of argumentative, but sort of a sense of where his heart's at as well. Like, so taking the slice out of his one, some of the first fruits, some of the crop, some of the fruits. We get some other slices of his life to look at, argumentative. He gets given a punishment. It's not, get out of my face, God. Takes off, I'm going to make my own way. So quite this essence of I can do it, I'm doing it myself, I'm doing it for myself, and I'm doing it myself. Whereas Abel, even though we get this little slice, only just a little slice, I think if we had another slice, that would also say that same thing, fat portions, firstborn. And Jesus and the New Testament says that Abel was righteous because of that. He had a righteous life because he was God focused. He was looking at the Lord, and he was wanting to do right by the Lord. And that's the prophetic element. It's his righteousness. He was killed for being righteous. And just in the same way, Jesus lived a perfectly righteous life and was killed for being righteous. Abel is one of the very, very early references to that aspect of the life of Jesus, of the Easter story. Killed for being righteous. And I think this is probably a kind of a theme of these prophets. So of the prophets picked up, and Jesus said, from the death of Abel right to the death of the last guy in the prophets, who was killed for his righteousness, right through, all of that spoke to him. All of that spoke to Jesus. All of that spoke about Jesus, about us, about who he was. So why did these people do this? It's a bit of a cost, eh? Why do they do this? And I think Hebrews really brings it, clarifies it, because they believed that there was something better. They looked at the cross. They didn't know what it was. They were putting this puzzle together. They didn't quite get it. They had a little bit of a feel for it. But they looked at it, and because of that, they believed there was something better. And so they set their life around the Lord. They set their life around Jesus and what he wanted, and trying to do right, and trying to intention them, their actions in a way that would please God, which was kind of, I mean, often the stories are like that, aren't they? One's going this way and the other one's going that way. So I kind of feel like that's where I'm going to leave it a bit, that we have this legacy that the prophets put this puzzle together. They didn't quite get it right. They missed quite a lot obviously a lot of people missed who Jesus was at the time. But they had set their direction, they set their focus, they set their intention, their will. They turned their mind over the things to try and live to please the Lord, to please God. And that was recognized by the Lord as righteousness. And we don't live towards the cross anymore. We don't need that. We live in the other direction. We live from the cross. So we are the inheritors. We are the legacy of those Old Testament prophets, of those guys and women that suffered and kept going and tried to do the right thing by God. So we live from that. We live towards hope that things will, again, be better. So I think I might finish it there. There's a lot more. First Peter really is worth a read. There's a lot about how to live a righteous life in there, which some of it feels a bit like sin management, and some of it is, to be honest. Some of it's about working with your head. It says you're not ignorant anymore. Ignorance implies no mind function, right? Be alert. It says be alert with your mind. Use your mind. Yeah. Sometimes I think we can be a bit passive as Christians. God, do it to me. But you know, Dallas Willis said this great little phrase, which is, effort's okay, earning's not. So it's okay. It's okay to put a bit of effort into pursuing God, into doing the right thing, into shaping our lives as godly people. But doing that as a means to earn something from God's not. So 1 Peter really worth a read. Also talks about a bit about loving each other deeply from the heart. Nice stuff, eh? Yeah, good stuff. So some quite practical stuff. So the one more thing I want to say about Abel was that the New Testament kind of says that Jesus on the cross did something that Abel could never do. And so even though Abel was a righteous man and he died for it, he was still an imperfect man, and his righteousness was not perfect. So the righteousness of Jesus perfected that Abel's righteousness, and it's the same for us. Whatever we do in our, whatever effort we put to it, we still have the righteousness of Jesus, the perfection, the knowledge that he can take whatever we've given him and take it just to another level. So I just want to leave it there, and that really is leaving it there. And going back to my first word, if you want a word today, then come up and grab a word. Thank you.